You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food and beverage radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
You're about to listen to a great episode of The Speakeasy featuring my good friend Aaron Polsky from Livewire. Aaron's in the middle of a raise to keep his company cruising right along. They're out there winning awards, and they just need some capital to keep moving forward. Aaron, where can they invest in Livewire?
So we are on WeFunder. Our page is www.wefunder.com/Livewire.
Amazing. And the fundraiser ends on the 29th, so go give. You'll hear more about it in the show, but I just wanted to make it clear to you where you can help out. Cheers, everybody.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson. We are missing Mr. Damon Bolte today. He's off, he's doing, he's got a pretty chill weekend coming up, I think. Just getting married, no big deal. So he's, probably trying to get ahead of that so he can really take it easy on Saturday.
Yeah, playing the part of bridegroom.
Yeah.
Many congratulations to him and Jamie out there. It's going to be amazing. I wish I could go, but too busy. Surprised you're not going. You're Mr. Wedding Attender.
I know. Of all the weddings I have to miss, I'm surprised it's the one that actually is speakeasy related. But no, I wasn't. This is the first one that I've had to take a pass on in a long time, unfortunately. But yeah, we wish them all the best. Best to you, Damon. Best to you, Jamie. Love you guys. And congratulations from afar.
Yeah, of course. You know, it's crazy. You've been to so many weddings. I've only been to two, and I've been in both of them. One of them, I was a groomsman, and one of them, I was the groom.
Yeah. I mean, if you go big or go home, you know?
Yeah, fun fact. Weddings are, I had to be coerced into being the groomsman. They're tough for me to go to. I don't know. There's too much emotion wrapped up in them. I can't get past it. Anyway, speaking of emotions and emotional triggers, you've been sharing your thoughts and recipes on the TikTok platform.
Yes, that's how the kids refer to each other, the TikTok platform at www.tiktok.com. But yes, I broke down.
They keep it on the internet.
Yeah, yeah, that's where you can find it. It's also, if you have an internet on your phone, you can get it there too.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, I finally broke down. I got a TikTok, and the thing that surprises and delights and repulses me is how much I actually enjoy it. As I did my duty as a millennial and poo-pooed it for a really, really long time, and then I got on and discovered that it's actually super fun. Like, the editing techniques on there are actually pretty, for like someone who got a minor in film and did a decent amount of editing in that a full 15 years ago, the technology that we had to go to a special like laboratory to do when I was in college is now basically on this app that you can download from anywhere in the world. It's nuts.
The world of editing and of producing good quality video content has become so democratized by platforms like TikTok and Instagram. Like I have a pretty solid foundation of it on Instagram, but I would know how to do none of this in a studio.
It's wild. It's wild. And like, I feel like saying this, like anyone who's listening to this, who's under the age of 30 right now, is just being like, well, duh. It's like, I went to a movie the other day and there was sound. Can you believe it? It was a little grainy, but it totally like really changed the experience, and I hated it. But no, I'm really enjoying my time on TikTok. It's a chance to, my shtick is that I'm doing one of my favorite things, which is drinking cocktails in the shower. I share a little shower thought, and then I share the recipe for whatever it is that I'm drinking. So it's, the people get a little recipe, they get a little know-how, they get a little laugh, they get to see a little skin. You know, you give the people what they want. It's what the public was crying for, and now they have it.
I mean, triple threat, some thoughtful philosophy, a cocktail, and some nudity. Way to go.
There you go. Yep. All in one package.
What's your handle? How can we find you on the TikToks?
So go to http://. I'm 100 proof Greg, same as I am.
Same.
On,
oh, good.
Instagram. But yeah, find me there and listen to some fun musings of mine. I'm having a good time making it, honestly. So I hope that anyone out there that's listening that wants to check it out has a good time looking at it too.
I mean, at least that seems to be the, you know, that was the original idea of the whole thing, right? Is to do something and be creative and have an outlet and enjoy yourself. You know, I think that so many folks, myself included, gets caught in the trap of like using it for work and becoming a brand opportunity, et cetera. And then it just becomes a tedious chore. As I mentioned off air, I started a TikTok a little over a year ago where I was reviewing bottles from the top of the Williamsburg Bridge. I was just calling it Bridge Bottle under Creative Drunk. And they're still there. And I do consider going back to it, but just it started to be work immediately. It kind of turned me off. But maybe if you're having a great time, I'll revisit, Greg. I'll check out 100 Proof Greg on TikTok and see what you're thinking and drinking.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it took a minute to kind of find the happy medium where it didn't feel like. But that's always been my problem with social media is like it's fun. And then you get like that first person finds you on your Instagram and is like, hey, like, check out this opportunity. Or like, do you want to collab with this brand? And it's great. And then it becomes immediately like, oh, shit, now I have to produce all this content. And it becomes a chore and something in the back of your mind. And so it's nice to find a lane that at least for now feels like something that I enjoy making. It's fun. It's a fun way to share some content. And speaking of people who have made a lot of different things over their careers, Souther, who do we have in the studio with us today?
Hey, we got a longtime friend of mine and friend of the show. Aaron Polsky is joining us from California. Good morning to you, Aaron. And we're going to talk about his young brand, Livewire, that's out there just crushing awards and taking on all comers. And then there's a bit of a controversy going on that we're going to get into. So there's some exciting content. Aaron, welcome to the Speakeasy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, buddy, it's always good to see you. Got to hang out with you a little bit in LA when I was out there doing the residency for Amore Margo at Death & Company. You dropped something in my ear that I thought was timely and needed to get heard. So we scheduled you as quickly as we could to get on the show. But talk to the audience a little bit first just about what Livewire is. That way they've got an idea of what it is, and then we'll get into what's going on with it right now.
Yeah, so Livewire is a ready-to-drink cocktail brand. We run it like a record label. So we sign award-winning bartenders or bartenders from award-winning bars to our label. We package their signature cocktail in can or bottle format, and we pay them royalties on their work. And, you know, the reason I started this, I was getting press. Actually, my first press was while I was at Amore Margo. I think it was like 11 years ago. And, you know, it was cool to see my name in print. And it was great to be in national publications. But, you know, and now the example of Drink Masters is one I've started using because I'm sure lots of listeners of your show watch Drink Masters on Netflix. And they're interested. They see all these amazing cocktails, but they can't drink any of them, right? And this is unique to the world of food and drink, where, you know, if you hear about an artist, you can go stream their music. If you hear about, you know, a musician, you can go stream their music. If you see that Everything Everywhere All at Once won an Oscar, you can go stream that, or you can at least go to a movie theater, right? You can't do that with cocktails. You have to go to somebody's bar if you read about or see their video or whatever. So this was a way, you know, for the industry to bridge that gap where, you know, we could have bartenders make amazing cocktails and sell them out in the world to the general public, either via mail order or, you know, in certain markets, we have brick and mortar distribution. So that was a need for me and a lot of my friends in the industry that needed to be addressed.
So basically the gist is each release of a cocktail is the sort of, in this analogy, the album, and then the artist is the bartender and they get paid royalties just like an artist would for the album. But the real crux of it seems to me that what your initial goal was is to get these products out of the, you know, four walls of whatever bar they were created in and into the hands of the consumer who's like, I've read about it. I wish I could go all the way to New York, but I live in Des Moines, Iowa, and I can't get there. But I'd love to have this cocktail from, you know, a bar that I've read about, from a bartender that I've maybe followed. And here's my opportunity, right?
Correct. And, you know, hopefully we can find an amazing bartender, you know, in Des Moines, Iowa, and get a New York drinker to be able to have their,
exactly, their cocktail. Exactly. It's a two-way, you know? fully a two-way street. And then there's a little deeper layer too, where the sort of artwork, et cetera, you want to get into that a little bit? Because I love that part.
Yes. Too. So every bartender can choose an artist to design their label, right? So it's really like an album. It's really a full creative work where everything from what's inside the can or bottle to what's on the outside is really the creative outlet of the bartender. And so it's really their work all the way through.
I love that. And all of the ones so far are very unique looking and very compelling to, you know, you want to grab them when you see them. And you're having some incredible successes, right? You've smashed a bunch of awards and you've taken on some golds at San Francisco. Is that right? San Francisco?
Yeah. So last year we won, two double golds, two golds, three silvers, one best in show, which means that we beat every single entry last year in the rated drink cocktail space, or over 700 of them. And this is sort of, you know, back in the day, what put Tito's on the map, right? The way they tell it, Tito was cleaning a still when he found out that he won best in show and he beat out the Grey Gooses and the Absolutes of the world. You know, so that was incredible. And we also won best in class for rum. This year, I think this is, the information may be embargoed depending on when this podcast is released, but we did enter Heartbreaker because it's the only cocktail we have that as of 2022 did not win higher than silver on anything. And I'm just like, not, I wanted a gold. You know, the results will be announced shortly. But
yeah, incredible.
Yeah.
So, and the company's pretty young, right?
Yeah. So we launched, I had this idea somewhere 2013 or so. Speaking of Damon, Damon and I, you know, and my Mayor Subarau, sort of like started working on some packaged cocktails in 2012, 2013. And I didn't have it in the same format. It was going to be just our cocktails. It wasn't going to be this like record label format. And I went out and pitched it to Anchor Distilling at the time, before it was called Hodling, and in San Francisco. And at the time, they were like, this is great, but I don't think anybody wants ready-to-drink cocktails, which I suppose at the time they were right based on empirical evidence. But, you know, that's when the sort of idea started, and I sort of played with it and at times, but I was working in different bar shifts, or bar positions. And then 2019, I decided to like, you know, raise a little bit of money. So I raised enough to make our first 400 cases, and we produced those on March 3rd of 2020, 10 days before the pandemic.
Yeah. Perfect timing.
Yeah.
But in the end, kind of not the worst timing, right? For ready to drinks. That was kind of like when suddenly every bar all over the country was making cocktails for people to take home. So maybe not the worst timing.
You know, I hear this. This is the exact comment I get every time somebody hears of our launch date. And the fact of the matter is, Heather, that like, I don't know what it would have been like if we had launched in 2018. I don't know what it would have been like if we launched in 2023. All I know is that I had nothing but time, nothing but energy and motivation. And, you know, I went out there. I was like, well, I guess this is it. You know, so it definitely changed our plans. I had a plan for a Florida launch date on March 30th, like a launch party, and a New York launch party on March 20th. None of those launch parties happened, so... We still haven't had a launch party. It's 3 years in, but I was able to fully focus on it. And so I kind of feel a little bit deprived of the ability to sit at home and do, you know, nothing for a couple of months. I feel like everybody got to do that. And I was just like, I got to go sell this stuff. I just made it.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that was it. That like effectively changed the course of my life.
And it's great. Like, it's a great product. You know, I think that what sets you apart is this business model, and that business model, I think, comes from your mind of how you went to school for music, right? Music business, in fact. So it seems like you've just applied that model to this arena, and it's doing quite well for you. And again, tons of awards. So you're making great product. I think the other thing that's important to note is that sets you apart from other RTDs is that, generally speaking, most RTDs out there are fermented product, whereas yours is using distillates and actual spirits, right?
I would say the majority of the volume of RTDs sold is with a malt base or a wine base. There are quite a few spirit-based products out there. That in and of itself is not our distinguishing factor when it comes to ingredients. Our main ingredient-based distinguishing factor is that we don't use juices. And everybody else uses juice, and they slap fresh juice on the label. But you know, the question comes up, right? How can it be fresh if this was made 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 months ago, right? So we don't.
Fun fact: all juice was at one point fresh.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And you know, as bartenders, we know that freshness is paramount to the use of juice, right? If it's not fresh, it won't taste good. It'll, in fact, taste actively bad. I like to describe it as a Minute Maid orange juice that's been left out in the sun for a couple hours or a couple of days is sort of what, you know, putting juice in a can tastes like. So we don't do that. We use really, really high quality flavors and extracts, and we use organic acids. And what that allows us to do is have a very stable acidity base to balance the sugar that we use, just as all cocktails use sugar. And the extracts really have this pure aroma. And so the marriage of the aroma plus the acid sugar balance allows us to achieve this incredible profile without it ever tasting like stale juice.
Yeah, that's incredible. I would love to hear at least a few thoughts, but then we really got the real topic I want to cut into, but I want to hear a few thoughts on how did you, as you know, just average guy bartender, I worked with you, leap from we're going to use fresh juices to make cocktails in-house to this place of what sounds like, you know, the science lab. Where did you get this knowledge base to create these things that are out there pleasing people and winning awards?
Yeah. So when I moved out to LA, I started working at Harvard and Stone about 6 months after moving. And Harvard and Stone is an award-winning bar out here in Hollywood, and also very high volume. It's also a music venue. It's a neighborhood bar, but we put out really amazing cocktails. So the owners really have a presence in the LA scene and the LA nightlife scene. And so they were asked by Coachella to do to have a bar at Coachella. Now there are lots of them, right? Now sort of, I think we blazed that trail in 2016, but after that, and along with another group, which at the time was called 2 on 3. Now, you know, PDT's out there doing it, Attaboy's out there doing it.
They look like they have a blast when they're out there too. They're to follow them on Instagram during Coachella is a real fun time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're sort of hanging out at your bar and taking it easy, it's real fun. I don't know how many of them were hauling kegs up the field, but you know, hey Jeff, keep doing what you're doing. You're doing a great job, buddy. So we at the time, you know, I was asked by my boss to run this whole group wide pop up for Coachella, and I was also told that there was pasteurized juice, and I am like vehemently anti-pasteurized juice, and I always have been. Well, not always, but one time I had to use it for an event, and I was like, this is wildly bad. I don't know how any bartenders can take themselves seriously and use this stuff. So I did not want to use it, and instead I decided to do an acid base for the juices, right? And I was already working with the flavor company that we work with now. So I was like, hey, can you send me lemon? Oh no, the first year I didn't do that. The first year I infused lemon and lime peels into our spirits, and I used this acid base. And we essentially, that was our workaround to using pasteurized juice, because we couldn't get like fresh. So, you know, and right, like before the festival started, the guy running all of the logistics and catering for the beverage side said, you know, people don't drink cocktails here. Don't worry about it. You won't be super busy. And it may have been true in all the years preceding, but word spread pretty quickly that the cabin, which was the name of our pop-up, had really good cocktails. And we had a line that was like consistently 50 people long. And our cocktails were on draft. It was, we were serving probably 15 cocktails a minute. And it was it was insane. And that formed the basis for this formulation, right? And so I went back to LA and we put some cocktails on draft. And, you know, throughout the year, I would refine the formulation. And then next year, you know, the following year, we'd get ready for Coachella and try something new or try something that we were serving throughout the course of the year and do it again. And so, you know, what I found was like the deft use of acids can really make a lot of things possible, right? So another thing we were doing was these snow cones, where we had a snow cone, like a shaved ice machine, and there were these boozy shaved ices. Our boss was, I think, grew up in Hawaii. And so to him, shaved ices were a thing. And he was very particular about it. So I made it with juice. And he was like, no, this isn't sticky enough. Like, this is not adhering to the ice like it should. And I didn't understand what he meant until I went to Hawaii this last January. And I got one. I'm like, cool, I get it. But at his direction, I reformulated it without juice and using acids. And it like had that density and viscosity. And it was able to stick. So there's like, you know, it's a tool. If you use it properly, you can really achieve a lot of amazing things.
I love that there's a little hidden Easter egg tie-in here, which is the work that you did at Harvard Stone, notably kind of a rock and roll bar that got you to Coachella, that made you dive deeper into how to create these acid bases as a music festival. And the whole thing ties back to your entire, you know, your schooling for music business, and ties into the business that you created that's based on a music model. Like, this is like, it all seems to be coming together.
There's a quote that or a speech that I draw a lot of inspiration from, and it's a Steve Jobs Stanford commencement speech. There are a lot of amazing nuggets in there, but one of them is that you connect the dots of your life backwards. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that really touches on it, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, if I hadn't done this, I wouldn't have done this. And if I hadn't done this, I wouldn't have done this. And you can either see it as like truism, like, of course, you only have one line of your life. But also you can look at it and be like, oh, wow, like these things really led into one another.
Sure. The old hindsight is 2020, right?
I also think the wisdom of that is like you never know in the moment what's going to be a formative interaction for you. Like I think about this a lot. Actually, I can trace like my entire time working in bars, at least, you know, legitimate ones, back to this interaction I had with a deeply weird roommate and her deeply weird boyfriend when I was living in Scotland. And they were the ones that mentioned, oh, hey, you like beer. I think the new Brewdog bar in town is hiring. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I went in there, I fired in a resume. I went in with this voice and a lot of can-do pep that really wore off by the time I was like 24. And, you know, got the job and now here I am. And it's just weird to think that like that chance encounter and that weird interaction had so many ripple effects, but you can't know that at the time. So just kind of like, you know, to me, the point of that is like, keep your eyes open, because you never know what dot is going to be significant when you look back.
True.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, Aaron, let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. And then we're going to come back and get into what's becoming a controversy with your company that maybe be kind of, that will hopefully be a defining moment. We'll be right back with Aaron Polsky from LiveWire.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
And we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network, where we're talking with Aaron Polsky of Livewire. We talked a little bit about his origin story and what all the connected dots that led him to where he is now. Now we're going to get into a topic that, despite my best efforts, comes up a lot on this show. We're going to talk about Mountain Dew. We had Souther's brief but very fiery bromance with Mountain Dew last summer, which resulted in me having to go downstairs to the bodega below my apartment and spend money that I earned doing whatever it is that I do on a bottle of Mountain Dew that I then put into my body where I live. And tried to mixing it with Sue's, and honestly, it was pretty good, I have to admit. But there's been a new Mountain Dew based development that we want to talk about a little bit on the Speakeasy. So, Aaron, talk to us about what's going on there.
Yeah. So, the name of our company is Livewire, and there is a Mountain Dew flavor that was released in 2003, I believe, called Mountain Dew Livewire. Now it's different trademark categories. Ours is alcohol, it's class 33, and theirs is soft drink, and theirs is registered with the qualifiers of soft drink, syrups for soft drinks, etc. But their trademark is for Mountain Dew Livewire. Now, for some context, there's a Mountain Dew Code Red, which is their red variant, and it came out I think a year before that in 2002. There's also a wine called Code Red that came out 10, 12 years later. It has a registered trademark. There's no problem. I spoke to their lawyer, and he said they never heard anything from PepsiCo. There's Mountain Dew Voltage, and there's also Voltage Vodka. Voltage Vodka came out significantly after Mountain Dew Voltage, and they coexist. Voltage Vodka's trademark is registered, no problem, nothing from Mountain Dew or PepsiCo. And there was even a wine called Livewire that came out in, I think, 2009 or 2010, anyway, like a number of years after Mountain Dew Livewire. Their trademark was registered. That wine ended up going out of business, but they coexisted in the market. There's been no issue. So when it came time to register a trademark or to file a trademark application, I was like, listen, it's Livewire. I see that there's this Mountain Dew Livewire, but this is a soda. It's very inexpensive. It's sold in a different market. There's no real cause for confusion, right? Like, without Mountain Dew in front of it, this Livewire means really nothing. And it's in a different class. So I filed a trademark application. We, I believe, so let's forward to today, right? On March 1st, 2023, Pepsi announced Hard Mountain Dew Livewire, right? Which is an alcoholic product that contains a name, Livewire, that we've been in existence now for 3 years. And I found out about this because one of our mutual friends actually sent me a DM that said, hey, congrats on the collab.
Right.
And I was like, that is not a collab. And somebody else tagged us in the comment as well. So, you know, that's how I found out about the existence of this. So, you know, we're really in this position where we now have to defend ourselves in the alcoholic group. In the alcoholic class against Mountain Dew, right? So like they had their trademark again in soft drinks, and it was fine. And now we're in this position where like now it's causing confusion. So what are we supposed to do?
And so far, none of this sounds unusual. If you have a trademark, you do your due diligence and you try and protect it, right? So nothing seems out of line yet, but it's the story gets a little darker, right?
Correct, I think. I mean, when we applied for our trademark, we applied for alcoholic and non-alcoholic. And this was sort of like not the smartest move, right? I thought that there was still not going to be cause for confusion by having a non-alcoholic Livewire. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the USPTO, rejected our application partly in due to that non-alcoholic class designation. So we removed it. That, I think, caught the attention of PepsiCo, and we got a C&D from them in late 2020. So we replied. We said, hey, you know what? You're right. We're going to not enter the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic market with the name Livewire. We're going to pull that. We'd also like to explore a coexistence with you, right? Where we have it in writing that we can have our alcoholic Livewire. We don't need it, but it's very helpful, right? Where we agree that we have our Livewire in the alcohol space and you don't enter that. And we don't enter the non-alcoholic space with the word Livewire. I didn't hear anything back. And so we know at this point that PepsiCo knows of our existence. And it's like hard not to if you're working in, like if you're putting out products in the hard in the alcoholic ready to drink cocktail space, like we do get a lot of press, right? We don't have a ton of advertising budget, but we do get a lot of press and we do get a lot of awards. So, and we have in writing that they know that we exist. So, but yeah, I mean, the timeline is funny, right? So they sent their C&D in 2020. We responded in 2021, in the first half of the year. We then got, there was also a kink, right? There was a beer that had a pending application for Livewire. And this beer, when you file a trademark, you have to file something called a statement of use in interstate commerce. So you have to basically prove that your product is being sold across multiple states and that it exists. And so this beer company, Roque, which has the Livewire IPA, had multiple extensions filed to file their statement of use. And unfortunately, because of that, our trademark, which was filed after them, couldn't really be addressed until they either filed the statement of use and were granted a trademark or abandoned their trademark application, which they ultimately did. So late 22, they abandoned their application, and that left it open to us. Now, the examining attorney for the USPTO, he refused our application initially because of the non-alcoholic inclusion. And I believe that we poisoned the well with that inclusion. And so in his mind, it's too close, like, and he sent another refusal. Now, the appeals board of the USPTO, called the TTAB, they overturn refusals all the time. There's, again, there are like 4,000 examining attorneys. It's like if they're set on something, they can remain set on something, and then you just have to take it and appeal it. But anyway, we unintentionally let our trademark application lapse on January 1st. And we were sort of exploring shifting our strategy. And I had already poured a lot of money into this application, money that we can use for inventory. And I sort of was going to let it lie and file new and different trademark applications. I'd go into details, but this is still part of our strategy, and we're still exploring it. So we let our trademark lapse on January 1st. And when you let your trademark lapse, if it's unintentional, you have a 2-month window to file a, hey, I screwed up. This was unintentional. Yeah, I want to revive it. A grace period, right? So 2 months after we let it lapse on March 1st was the day that PepsiCo announced hard Mountain Dew Livewire. Launch party, this and that, whatever. And I don't think it was a coincidence because, again, we interacted. Right. They know that we exist. Now, what they didn't know was that our grace period started on January 17th. It's from the date of a notice that was mailed to us. And we filed a petition to revive our trademark application, and we were granted it. So, but by then, they had already released their product. So yeah, that is, that's where we're at. We basically are, you know, there's been confusion in the space. We don't contest at all that PepsiCo has the rights to Livewire in the non-alcoholic space in the Mountain Dew context. But now we're in this position where we need to be, you know, on the offense to defend our trademark.
Right, which is, mm-hmm. I'm going to guess, because everything is a costly endeavor.
Yes. So in filing the petition to revive and our subsequent appeal, right, I couldn't really pay a lawyer at this point, right? Like, I've paid a lawyer a lot. And, you know, when you do it, it's really not that... like, there's a lot of nuance and technicality to it, but it's not the most difficult thing to understand, right? You basically go online and search for cases, and those cases say on top in the black box, this can be cited as precedent of the TTAB. Or it says this cannot be cited as precedent. So you find these cases that apply to you, you cite them, and then when you find them, there are like 10 more cases that they cite and 10 more cases that those cases cite. And so you can really get down this rabbit hole, which would have cost me like 30 to 50 lawyer hours. Right. And, you know, as a lawyer, you kind of see that it's a small business. They can't really afford to do this. And so your advice is just roll over and change your name.
Right.
And to me, that is like not, you know, that it doesn't set a good precedent in the world of entrepreneurship and competitive business practices, but it's also not right, right? Like, Pepsi can send the C&D all they want. Like, our examining attorney can overturn or can refuse a registration all he wants, but like, they're not the final authority on this. And, you know, they don't, in my opinion, have a real legal basis for their insistence. So we change our name. Right. And so this is not the first time they've done something like this. There was a soda called Dewdrop.
Yeah. I remember you were telling me about this in LA. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like this independent entrepreneur. She created this wellness soda. She had a registered trademark for it. PepsiCo sent her a cease and desist saying that it was too close to Mountain Dew, which is absurd, right? Mountain Dew, right. And Dewdrop, right? Yeah. There's no nobody who's out there shopping for Mountain Dew will see this tall, skinny can with this, like, you know, color blocked pastel, whatever art on it and think, hey, right, this is a new offering from Mountain Dew. And they sent her a C&D. They intimidated her. She changed her name to Droplet. And then PepsiCo released what she alleges is a copycat called Soul Boost. And it's like the art is very similar. The packaging is very similar. The touted wellness attributes are very similar. And they bought product from her in that interim period. So they bought it. She alleges that they copied it. And, you know, like, their product doesn't even do that well. I think it has like 1,000 or a couple thousand Instagram followers. And it's like for them, for PepsiCo, it's like, yeah, sure, let's put this out and see if it sticks, right? But for her, it's her livelihood.
Yeah.
And it's like,
right. So just another intimidation technique to get people to get out of the marketplace.
Right.
Yeah. Game it out for us. What's the best outcome you could see from this, and what's the worst?
The best outcome is that PepsiCo and LiveWire reach an agreement where
just simply coexist, PepsiCo's, right?
Yeah. Simply coexist. They don't use LiveWire in alcohol. They don't give us any more grief for using LiveWire in alcohol. And that's it. The worst.
But I suppose, the other side is that you, but then also you wouldn't be able to enter into the non-alc with LiveWire, right? It's a two-way street. Yeah.
Correct. We're planning on entering the non-alc, but with a different name. I've already, retired that idea. But, the worst is that we fight it through every level of courts, up to the Supreme Court, I assume, and lose. That's the worst. And we have to change our name.
Yeah. And spend a lot of money to do it.
Yeah. Let me just ask this, is that, because this seems a bit funny to me, and I'm not sure if you have... It's crazy the things you have to become an expert in very, very quickly when you're in this space. Like, yeah, I bet you never really imagined, I bet you never saw one of those dots of your life being like, I need to research copyright law, but here we are. It seems to me like you would have whatever the legal equivalent of squatter's rights is for being in this space and being in the market and being a recognized brand entity that had a trademark for 3 years at this point. It seems to me like that would give you some sort of legal standing. Is that not the case?
Correct. So there are a couple of concepts here. The first is common law trademark. So like copyright, right? When you write a song, you committing it to a tangible medium, right? So like if you write a song and record it on your voice app on your phone, you technically have a copyright to that song, right? It's not registered yet. That's a separate process, and you can register it to the Library of Congress. But just by virtue of existing in a tangible medium, that song is copyrighted. So same applies in trademark, right? So you can have a registered trademark with the USPTO, or just by existing and doing business, you can have a common law trademark, which is what we currently have. Because of that lengthy registration process with the IPO sort of stalling, or the IPA sort of stalling it, we still don't have a registered trademark. This is what we just got granted the petition to revive, and it's now going back to that examining attorney. I don't know where he's going to be on this, but I think I wrote a pretty good case for him to examine. And if he refuses again, we're going to take it to the U.S. TTAB, the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. But by existing, but the catch with common law trademarks is that they only apply where you have done business. So we have distribution in 8 states. So the common law trademark applies in those 8 states, and they're good states, right? That, if it holds up very strongly, then PepsiCo wouldn't be able to use Mountain Dew LiveWire in California, Florida, Texas, Louisiana, Nevada, New York, New Jersey.
That's all of them, right? That's all the states?
There's one left. Yeah, that's all the states. Oh, yeah. That's all the states, yeah. In America. so that's the common law trademark that we have. But registering a trademark gives you protection nationally and in some international agreements as well. So for us, it was so vital to keep our application alive because it extends to the date of the application. And so it extends back to February of 2020, right? Mm-hmm. And so we want those protections in place retroactively. And we already have trademarks to the individual names of our cocktails, right? We have the trademark to Golden God. We have the trademark to Holy Tiger, to Crystal Shiso Mojito. So it's really getting our brand name trademarked as well. And that's been a real uphill battle. And now is, a bit of a war.
Is there anything that we or our audience could do to advance your efforts? Or is it just something that you have to do on your own?
spread the word, right? You know, I'm not going to ask anybody to do any pro bono litigation, but spreading the word really helps. A lot of times, entrepreneurial brands back down from multinational corporations because they're intimidated and don't have the money and they have to change their name or whatnot. I think this practice is harmful to the business of our country and you know, the leaders of small business. And I want a spotlight on that, right? On that common practice that these large companies do. And listen, I'm not faulting anybody for protecting their trademarks, right? Like, you have to do that, in fact, right? You have to, anytime that somebody, like, I don't know if the Speakeasy podcast is trademarked, but like, if there's a show that comes out called The Speakeasy, you know, and you have a trademark for The Speakeasy podcast, you should probably send them a cease and desist. My issue is how overreaching it is, right? And that's the issue, right? Like, PepsiCo sending a cease and desist to Dewdrop, saying that it's too close to Mountain Dew, is overreaching.
I think so as well. Yeah, there's no potential audience or consumer confusion in those two names, right?
Correct.
And especially with yours being alcohol versus non-alcohol and completely different artwork and all those things, it seems a bit ludicrous. It's just a great name and they want it.
That's it. That's what it is.
So there, you created a great name. Well, listen, let's talk about something a little bit more up-tempo. Not that that's down-tempo. You seem pretty calm about it, and I'm applauding your sort of reserved nature regarding going facing this, because it sounds like pretty fucking daunting. So that's a lot of courage, and I applaud you for that.
I appreciate that.
Let's talk about something a little bit more up-note. You're currently amidst a raise for the company, right? You're raising capital and funds. Let's get into that a little bit before we have to wrap up.
Yeah, so we are on WeFunder doing an equity crowdfunding raise. So it's a really interesting concept. It was it became a possibility for entrepreneurs via the Jobs Act, which was an Obama era law that passed. And essentially, there are multiple websites that allow you to raise from your community. And this is really the first time ever where you can go to your friends, your grandparents, your fans, your followers, and you can raise from them. And it's regulated by the SEC, and you can raise as little as, in some cases, $100, in some cases, $250 from these people. And so it gives the everyday consumer the opportunity to invest in early stage startups without being worth a certain amount. And we can get into more of that and how investing regulations work. But, you know, so we're doing this raise. It's been going great. I think we've raised $130,000 so far. And what it allows us to do is expand into new territories and create more inventory and have that cash flow to do it. One of the hardest things in this business is cash flow. So, like, oftentimes for one of my raw materials, I might have to pay for it in full 4 weeks before it ships. And then the alcohol business, you know, if my distributor or I, right, if I sell a case of Livewire to Amore Amargo, Amore Amargo has 30 days to pay for it. And so if you do the math
or even 90, like, I often have 90 day terms.
Right? Really?
Yeah. In New York.
Oh, wow. I did not know this. Yeah. Well, that's even worse for us, right? It's good for you. Yeah, it's worse
exactly.
for us.
Exactly.
But this results in, if you don't have very deep reserves, this results in some significant cash flow issues. So what you've got is, like, I got to pay, let's say I pay for my whiskey on January 1st. It ships to me on February 1st, which means that I get it probably on February 10th. I have to schedule my production run with a window so that my ingredients aren't coming after a production run, right? So let's say it's February 20th, right? So we make it, we have to ship it to a warehouse So let's say it gets there on March 1st. So that's 2 months of paying for something that we haven't actualized, that we haven't even sold. And at that point, we can ship it and sell it. The distilleries generally have, you know, our contract distillery has a minimum run. So we have to make 400 cases per SKU at least, right? So it's not like we make what we need and we sell it immediately. Like we make what the least amount that we can. So we have five cans. That means 2,000 cases that we've made that we then need to sell. So like if we sold all of that on April 1st and shipped it all on April 1st, we wouldn't get payment from that. If everybody pays on time, we wouldn't get payment from that until May 1st. So it's like I've paid for stuff on January 1st and the money comes in for it 5 months later. But like, let's say that some people are mailing their checks, right? And so it's even more.
Checks in the mail.
And then, right. But like, that's another 10 days, right? It gets to the office, which is, you know, in New York. So people are mailing checks from California. It gets to the office. Takes a few days to clear. So we're literally at 24 weeks of this negative cash flow. So, you know, for us to do all the things we want to do, we have to, you know, have these reserves. And that is really what the raise and really most capital raises in the world of alcohol are for, right? And if we expand to another territory, we have to allocate that cash. So like we just expanded to Nevada. Incredible opportunity. Julian Cox was the beverage director of MGM, and he brought us into the Bellagio, the Aria, and the Vidara pools. Huge pools, amazing venues. And so we ship a lot of inventory to Nevada. And so again, when you add a new territory or a big expansion, you have to make a bunch of product. So you've got that like that cash flow issue again. It's a blessing. It's amazing to do this, right? Like, but in that initial expansion step, you need to be plowing money into production. And so that that's just a challenge that you face in this business. And what's great with WeFunder and all of these platforms, StartEngine, SeedInvest. Oh, StartEngine actually just bought SeedInvest, but is that you don't have to find VC firms or find individuals whose net worth is over $1 million, which used to be the requirement for raising money. You can go to anybody, and there are safeguards in place on WeFunder to protect people from overinvesting, right? So like you can't invest more than a certain percentage of either your income or your net worth. And it just democratizes it, right? So you get to go to anybody and they'll be like, you know what? I don't have much, but I want to support you. Here's $250. And to them, they, depending on how it works, they might own a piece of equity. They might own a piece of revenue share. There are several different possibilities here, but you literally can invest in new companies that you believe in.
Yeah, well, you know, Amori Margo and Overthrow Hospitality is about to do a StartEngine raise later this summer. So, you know, I'm right in the beginning phases of all this. So I'm happy to hear that you're in it and you're crushing it. You're about halfway, you said, I think, to your goal of 250,000, which is incredible.
Yeah, so our first goal was 50,000, and we smashed it right out of the gate. And our next goal is 250,000, and our next goal is 500,000 if these next 10 days go really well. And we can raise up to $1 million. So
right,
it's, you know, it's an amazing platform, and I'm excited about this last run.
So again, you want to give it the website, and the deadline is April 29th if people want to invest on your WeFunder.
Correct. WeFunder.com/LiveWire.
Great. Easy enough.
I just want to ask Aaron, as we're you know, coming into the end of the show here, you know, this has been, I can only imagine what a deep dive this must have been into like investment law and copyright law and all this other, you
logistics
know, all of these things that
like,
yeah, exactly.
Like you're just making a cocktail.
yeah. And what is that? I just want to know, what is that like for you? What is that like to go from being like, oh yeah, I love being a bartender. I love, you know, stirring drinks and giving them to people. And then all of a sudden you're here. Like, how does that just feel for you personally as part of your, you know, your journey along this dotted line?
Yeah, I mean, it's a wild journey. It's a bit of a cliche, but they say that entrepreneurship is jumping out of a plane or jumping off a cliff and building a plane, learning how to build a plane on the way down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you learn a lot. You're ideally, you want to outsource to other members of your team, or you want to hire for the weaknesses that you have. But it's, you know, I love learning on the job, and, it's, you know, it's at times humbling. It's at times very stressful, extremely stressful, especially so that you mentioned logistics, but like that freight and logistics are the most stressful part of my job on a daily basis.
I can't even imagine, but, to be honest, even the story you were painting for us was giving me agita.
Well, I apologize for any sort of cortisone that I set free in you. But, you know, it's ultimately I wake up every day knowing that I'm doing what's right for me and what I want to be doing. Right. So like, regardless of how stressful it is, I'm building equity in my future and the future of bartending and changing the way that the world drinks. And I think that that's important. And you know, satisfying and gratifying.
Man, I'm well said, and I couldn't be happier for you out there. You know, even with these adversities, you seem to be going at it with a great attitude, and I feel like you're going to persevere over this whole situation. But really awesome to have you on again. People can find you on Instagram at, it's just Livewire, right?
Drink Livewire.
Drink Livewire on Instagram. Any other platforms you want to plug for people to go follow and spread the word?
Yeah. We have a TikTok. We have a Drink Livewire TikTok.
It's the future, baby.
It's not our most active platform, but, you know. So Drink Livewire on TikTok, Drink Livewire on Instagram, drinklivewire.com. If you want to buy some cocktails, get them shipped to you. We have free shipping on all orders. And my personal is Aaron Polsky, AaronPolsky. That's my Instagram.
Awesome. Well, we'll get as many people pointed towards you as we possibly can. And really hopeful that you break your goal on the WeFunder. Again, that ends on April 29th. So go check that out. Really incredible having you on again. That's it for this week's episode of The Speakeasy. Be sure to tune into Heritage Radio Network for plenty more shows just like this one. Go to the website, heritageradionetwork.org. Click on the beating heart to donate to keep shows like this one on the air. Thanks again, everybody. Cheers.
Cheers. And congrats again, Damon. So you don't shun the devil with your rock. The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.